Welcome to another episode of Multifamily Collective, brought to you by the Multifamily Media Network. I'm your host, Mike Brewer, and today we are talking with Stephen Ray, Multifamily Ninja. Stephen, welcome to the show.
I appreciate that. So excited to be here, excited to see you again. Chat a little bit about multifamily today, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I know it's been some time since we last saw each other. I think it was Blueprint back in September of last year. I think that's right. Last time.
Yeah, I think that's, we have been connected on LinkedIn for a while, as are like most people, I guess, at certain, for lack of a better term, levels of the industry, you kind of collect people along the way. But I think that was the first time we actually met in person as well. So it was good, fun little round table that Dom with 20 for 20 put on, and it was great. So excited to go a little bit further. Although I will say one thing, LinkedIn, so I think because you had said, so Multifamily Ninja is actually the title I gave myself because I wanted to be a ninja. I'm like a small child. Probably since the Three Ninja movies. I don't know if you remember those in the like early 90s. We don't need to, but always wanted to be a ninja, and finally have a chance to put it, like, give myself my own job title and put that on the business card. LinkedIn's showing it because that's my only role at this company. It's like, it's displaying it almost like inverted. And I thought I did it back anyway, it's its own little story, but I was like, how did I put this backwards? And then I went and looked, and it's not backwards. It's just weirdly not intuitive. So the company's name is Chasing Tomorrow AI.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, Multifamily Ninja is the fun job title that, maybe a little inspired by Elon and his, his CFO was like the chief of coins at some point, whatever it was, the Game of Thrones reference. So
his book, I think about 100 pages from reaching the end of that thing. I think 600-700 pages long. The one that Isaacson that wrote.
Yeah. Walter Isaacson, I think.
Yeah. To that point, Elon's a fascinating character, and there are lots of things from job titles to, you know, the biggest rocket or the heaviest thing ever going to space. I don't know. There's lots to unpack there.
he's just interesting in general. I've gotten kind of obsessed with, so now we're more on the prop tech side of things, as spent most of my career in management. There's a guy going around named Joe Justice who's talking about how Tesla and SpaceX both do their agile manufacturing. So Joe Justice worked for Bill Gates and then Jeff Bezos and then ended up with Elon. So he has quite the resume. Oh, wow. But he talked about why the Musk companies are different. And a lot of it is this way that there's like no middle management. It's all engineers. They just build stuff and fix stuff, and they can prototype stuff and put them from prototyping concept to 3D printed it on a car, like within the same workday. Which is insane. That's super fascinating guy. I've not started the book yet. I haven't. It's in my queue, I guess you could say.
I got to tell you, it is well worth it. And you bring up a great point that could be a jumping off point or something that doesn't really fit in the episode, but it is. It's going to make it in. And that is that, you know, the engineers, one of the things in the book he talked about, it is a very flat organization, but there are people that are tasked with sort of the business side of the Musk companies, right? And then there are engineers that actually bring those things to life. And one of the sections in the book talks about how Elon gets very, very frustrated when, you know, the output or the outcome is not what he had in his head. And typically it's a breakdown between the engineer and the business guy, right? Mm-hmm. And the correlation I'm trying to draw here is in multifamily, right? When software developers are out there developing software, let's call them engineers in this case, they're sometimes solving problems in a way that doesn't really fit business case. And the missing link here is you don't have these people sitting next to each other, which was the punchline for Elon. He said, okay, great, you're going to have your desk right next to this guy, and that way I get my outcome.
Yeah, that's, I think it plagues a lot of business. It definitely is, you know, multifamily has tons of middle management layers that, you know, I think one of the, and this actually wasn't on some of the notes I sent you, but one of the biggest misses that our industry's had, at least for my entire career, is I don't know of many companies that have a programmatic regional manager training program. Right? That actually teaches you your job. because they think their job is occupancy, because that's all they've been told their entire career. Maybe they like see NOI and they like see these numbers, but it's all kind of abstract because they're not actually taught how values arise and like what we actually do as property managers. And almost every person who gets promoted to regional manager goes through the same process that takes varying lengths, where they start out as a multi-site property manager, like when they first get promoted, and they're still doing a lot of the stuff on site and still micromanaging. And then they either burn out and quit, or they eventually figure it out, usually within like 6 to 18 months. They're like, oh, I can't be everyone's crutch.
That's right.
And I have to start leading and doing things differently. And that was always curious to me, how did we not, is it because the kind of asynchronous nature in which they like come to exist? I know when I was at Roscoe, like I guess RPM before it was RPM, we had a policy that Angelique Goodenough, Jason and I put kind of worked together to put in place, where if you're regional, you had 2 years to get your CPM. And we kind of backstopped the training need with the IRM CPM designation. So like I got mine while I was still on site at Roscoe, which was incredible to have that kind of breadth of awareness still touching the site stuff.
That's right.
But that, I mean, and we would insist people travel to other markets so they could get exposure to other people, took every class in person, at least all the math classes in person. And I think that's a big contributor to the kind of the density of talent that RPM/Roscoe had from the early 2010s up through like obviously where they are today, that allowed for that kind of growth. Because that doesn't happen in this business. Right? Like I gave myself a fun weekend project, or like a Saturday afternoon project, because this is what I do for fun. I downloaded all the NMHC top 50s and I like indexed them into Airtable based on company. And then I started just looking at average change each year, like average growth, biggest grower, smallest grower, how many new were in, how many dropped out. And it's a pretty static group, like at least for the last decade, like surprisingly so. Not a lot of movement. You have like 5 people who came in really. No one made the big moves other than RPM and Asset Living, where they like jumped way up. There's a couple that kind of slow and steady did it, but it was an interesting kind of, I don't know what my takeaway is there yet. I'm still trying to think about that. Like, what does this actually mean? I don't know how I got on that after regional training, but that's why I think RPM was able to grow so fast was, they had a lot of really talented and grounded regionals and like what the job was. And then you don't get some of the silliness that we see today with, we have to raise your rent because we can't have negative tradeouts, or the software told me I had to raise it. So I can't like use my brain and recognize that if I have to put this on the actual market, I'm going to get, tanked. So,
yeah. It's interesting, just one item of note. I know the NMHC top 50 came out just today for this past year. So that'll be interesting to unpack that again. But one remark I would make about the regional manager, because I do agree with everything that you just said, even my own personal experience in growing through the ranks over the years, I was a regional manager for some bit of time. And one of the things that this is based on one guy's experience, so this might not be a broad thing for the industry, but there was this divide between asset management and operations, right? And asset management would rarely, if ever, invite regional managers into the room, into the underwriting room, right? Because inevitably, the regional manager, because they're closer to the business, they start talking about things that aren't necessarily germane to the conversation that we're having at hand. But if there were time spent, you would give people, regional managers, insight into how value is created and what, coming in cap rate and exiting cap, all those things that I think that lend to your point, they don't get exposed to.
Yeah. I ran training at Roscoe for 3 years, or I guess I built training and then ran training and taught every new employee who came in. I basically took my CPM, like everything I learned getting my CPM, and just ported it over.
Yeah.
But we had 2 big day one things that we taught. One was a survey on like what to do if you smell gas. It's like, call the fire department, run. And like the last was like call a plumber, which is obviously the one we actually want people to do. Yeah. And then the other one was like, when can you drain a pool? And the answer was never. That was a trick question. If you picked anything, you got it wrong. Because nobody who was taking that test was ever allowed to make the decision to drain a pool, because we had one pop out of the ground the year before,
Oh yeah, that
which is always fun. But then the other thing that was really interesting that I taught that I thought helped people resonate kind of in a simple way, what we do is I taught the value of $4 and just applied a $4 average increase over a year at a 250 unit community. And then, look at that on a 5 cap and a 10 cap. And what does that mean to value? And it just gives like a framework for people to think within. Because if they're not touching it every day, they're not going to remember it. But if they can
That's right.
remember there's like an exponential here to these dollars, maybe they think about them differently.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there has to, I mean, kudos to you for taking what you learned in CPM and putting it into a corporate training environment. Because it's one thing to sit in those rooms at CPM, get your CPM right, and sit in those rooms, and you have these isolated business cases. And but to do it with real world business, to actually sit in a room talking about a real property that you have a real impact over, is, in my head, it imbues a little bit differently in that context, right?
Yeah, but that's where learning also comes from, right? The relatability, and especially with adults. So I actually was fortunate. I went to IRM instructor training shortly after getting my CPM. So the class that changed my career was their intro to finance class. So that's like where the light bulb came on. I was like, oh, cap rates, like, and some of that content's now moved to the asset management series. They've shuffled it around a few times, but I felt like I had to teach that class. That class changed my career. Like definitively, I have a straight line back to that moment when I was like the lights came on. So I was committed to teaching. We learned a lot about adult education, which is basically all of our training departments. And if you're not leading with what's in it for them, and then reminding them what's in it for them, and then just making sure they understood what's in it for them and why this matters, like, and not why you think it matters, but like really like in a tangible way, why they should pay attention, and then finding ways to then relate it to their day to day. Whether it's like to a property or to something that they might experience, using that to like soliciting feedback and getting them to share stories, that's where you create a mental connection with something that will then allow you to retain the concept in a much more like meaningful way, as opposed to like cramming for a test where then it's gone afterwards. Because cramming for a test is just like, key value pairs. It's not really thinking through like what does this actually mean in like some sort of deep level. So yeah, that would make sense that I hadn't thought about in that way with what I did, but yeah, that was very much meant to make it relatable and make it I mean, we probably had like 3 out of like every 100 employees who started, like who really got it in that first lesson, but
Sure.
those were 3 people who wouldn't have had it otherwise. And I can think of one of them who's like one of their main big RVPs, like senior RVPs right now. And so the ones who are kind of destined to keep going are usually the ones who get it pretty early as well.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. So for you note takers out there, make sure you write down intro to finance for that's an IRM course, is that right?
Yeah, FIN 402. I will hopefully be back teaching it next year, so I have a couple years off. But yeah, it's the CPM is to me a little bit different than CAM or CAPS because of the education that you have to take. And it's I got better after at my job after every single class. Like I came back and I had new things. I was better at it. So it wasn't even about like the certificate on the wall or the pen. Like that's nice, but that it was I got better at my job. And then we saw that at Roscoe across like 25 regionals probably. And they all got better at their jobs. So which is just also it makes it that much more confusing as to why we haven't no one's built anything really internally. Or I mean, I'm not aware of everyone's training department, but I feel like if it was out there, I might have stumbled across it at some point.
Yeah,
So
I know the company I was last with, we were intentional about building out some coursework in Laura Truitt, who is no longer in the company. She built it out. She did a wonderful job, and she really did touch on some of those aspects that you talked about. But listen, that was like 4 years ago, and this industry's been around for what, 50 years?
yeah,
It's
well, and it hasn't changed really at all. And we fool ourselves into thinking that it's changed because we have slightly different tools,
That's right.
but we haven't recognized that the processes and the job roles and functions are identical to what they've. And we're just now starting to see some change with centralization with that. But that, like, my thesis that multifamily is horribly broken and nobody really notices or is like paying close attention. a lot of that's born out of like it started with digging into like, why is our sales role our entry level position? And then why, when they're sick, do we hire a temp? Like, who knows nothing about our property and nothing about, and then we entrust them with tours. Like, this is crazy. Like, what in what other industry that does, you know, your people who do legitimately millions of dollars in sales a year, right, with leases.
Right. That's right.
They're responsible for and renewals and on the customer service side. And we're just going to trust our lowest paid, least experienced, like, person who got sales training in a classroom, which isn't sales training, right? Like,
that's right.
That's sales process training. But you, like, you learn to sell by selling. Like, most companies have like the, like a mentorship program or like an understudy and a, right? Like, you shadow, yep. Basically,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
And, right. And that's, we talk about that in the business, but it doesn't really happen. Right.
So let's unpack that. I don't mean to cut off your thought, but why do you think that is? Everything that you just said is abundantly true, but nothing changes. Why do you think that is?
I think it started because of having to take bank bags to the bank and having like paper ledgers, right? Like legitimately, like I think that's where, when your property manager had to be like the trusted person, and when your like second key was your accounting person, right? You didn't prioritize. And it wasn't until the late 90s when we started having all these like 300, you know, mid to late 90s is when the big, well amenitized property like became a bit of a thing.
Yeah.
So it wasn't until then that you had really had bigger teams and you might really have the need. And it's like the thing we were talking about, I think right before we started recording, is you have new media or new ways of doing things that get adapted to the old way. Right. And then sometimes it evolves and sometimes it doesn't. I think that's where it started. And then, you know, Greystar is the biggest company, obviously, a property management company in the world, so they're an easy one to look at. If they had to flip that and retrain all their leasing agents as front desk, front office admin people, because that's really what that role should be. Like, learn the business, talk to customers. We don't need to sell anything yet. You don't need to, right? Like, let's just get a feel for how the job works. Pay them to do data entry and paperwork, as opposed to having our property managers do the majority of that on site. Should be like misalignment of talent. But I think it's just the legacy of what was necessary. And then no one, I'm sure people have thought to change it, but it just never fit. I worked for an owner operator in 2019. It's a very small one. And I was like, I'm going to change it. I could not hire people because everyone applying for the admin assistant job thought it was like the second, like the assistant manager job. And everyone applying for the leasing job, because like the industry has just been shaped to like think that this is entry. And even those who aren't in the industry, like who are coming in, you know, they hear, oh, get a leasing job. But I can't imagine, like, when I was in my late teens, I worked at a car dealership. I was like locked in a classroom for a month before they even let me out of the room to talk to a customer. I had to know everything about every car.
Yeah.
And you know, today, how many leasing agents have shopped their comps? Probably single digit percentage.
Right.
So how do they even know what they're selling or selling against? Right. Like that's, we don't teach sales. That's part of kind of my, so that's that looking at the job roles evolved into thinking, oh, this applies almost everywhere. Like where we haven't either adapted or where we're not teaching the right things to the right people because we've deemed them at one point incapable. Right. But as opposed to saying, well, maybe if we taught them, they'd like rise up to meet this new expectation. And then we give like an on-site manager a dashboard with 1,000 data points like flashing at them and a yelling resident and, you know, an email inbox that's pinging every 5 seconds. And then they hit a crisis and we expect them to make the right decision or like even just throughout the day to prioritize what to do next. And that's a completely unrealistic expectation to put on most people when they don't even really know what they're doing. They're just surviving. And I think I think you see that in a lot of properties like in the business right now where most people are just trying to hang on.
You know, you bring up a really good point. We do a wonderful job as an industry of creating a fantastic environment for producing little t trauma in people. And it's real, right? The anxiety, I remember being on site. And look, not every single second of every single day is what you just described. But there are a lot of moments and stretches of moments where the anxiety level goes up, the cortisol pours in, and you're just like, I got to save my life right now in terms of serving the customer, satisfying my boss, getting these reports over to the RM on time, doing all this, answering the phone, people screaming. That's a real thing. And I think my guess is part of what you're on a mission to do, and maybe you can unpack this for us, is look, there is a better way to do business. And there is a moment in time, and that time is now, because technology is caught up for these processes. Let's do this. So what are you kind of like thinking about?
So I mentioned, you know, I was at the small owner operator in 2019, tried to fix it, didn't really work. But learned a lot through that process. I worked for a company called ResProp from, 2020 through the end of last year. And while I was there, I did, like, in my middle year of those three, I had a chance to do this initiative that I call podular management, where it was, essentially micro, what I thought, like, small management companies, all to keep the organization kind of flat, where you'd have an accountant on every team, like a marketing person on every team, like you pull the departments down, and because departmental silos and other, without going off on that tangent, it's another thing that hurts. But ultimately that also didn't work. And I realized part of the problem was the tools weren't there, with AI. And then the other big piece was, you were trying to take people from like the job role they're used to and the move them to something that looks similar, but it's actually very different. And but if you do it the way you did the old one, it's going to completely screw you. The best example of that was, we were running centralized maintenance in these pods, and we kept putting very experienced leads in that maintenance manager role, which was really more of a dispatch role and scheduling role. And for people whose entire careers and like esteem was built around fixing things and being the person who got called to fix things. And now they're overseeing a 1,000-unit portfolio and they want to go fix an AC. And I'm like saying like, no, like if you fix that AC, we're losing time. Like I know it feels good, but and we went through three people before that light bulb went off. It was like, oh, I got to hire something completely different. I can't just go plug in a lead. But the software tools were also probably the biggest shortcoming. And I got a little obsessed with AI last year, like most people. Around the time Blueprint was going on, though, I kind of taught myself Python. I found some really good prompts that had probably 100x my learning. Like I was just consuming knowledge at a pace that I couldn't ever remember in my adult life, anything being like it. And I was like, wow, this is really powerful. It's like, I'm learning this fast. And then Microsoft released an open source project in October that allows you to get agents to chat to each other. Like, so two different like LLMs could have a conversation and that unlocks a lot of really interesting things. Especially when you can have multiple ones and they can all, like one could be fine tuned to do this one specific thing. And just all these things that I've known and that most people in the industry know are like best practice, right? When you get a work order, you should look at the work order history, right? But how many people actually look at the work order history to like see has this come up before or even at a previous resident? Did we just replace this same like heating element on the stove? Like, or is this the third heating element we're replacing? Why aren't we just going to do stove? All these, like, again, best practice book. Like, if you read a book about it, they would be there. But they're not there because people are busy or people don't know. But those things drive outcomes, right? And you mentioned, like, those moments of the busy office.
Yeah.
Now, not universally, but I think a lot of those are usually attributed to like something that went wrong previous.
That's right.
So something wasn't fixed right. Now that resident comes back in. So you have this like compounding effect of like this thing that should have been handled 2 weeks ago is still here on top of the thing I'm currently doing, which is going to make those behind. And then you get into this like death loop that, especially on older assets, like if you had something that's built in the 80s or 70s or 80s, like, especially if you're still like 1 to 100 on your maintenance, like those guys are grind. They're doing everything they can. You can't afford to fall behind. And it's usually like that sort of thing that'll happen, where like a make ready that wasn't done in time or fell through the cracks. Well, what if you could make some things don't fall through the cracks anymore? And there's a lot of energy building AI tools that, like I think the leasing chat, the leasing agent for you, or chatbot, or the one that'll do collections, or all the, but I don't think that's where a lot of the value gets unlocked, right? That's just like taking a human out. That's not improving the performance of the property. And we're in an industry where one in three residents say that they're not happy with management. Half of those, so one in six residents, that's the primary reason they're moving. But most residents who move have that in their top three, as to why they move. Like you do have the people, the change in job, change in family status. Like there's other reasons people leave, but like our customers are telling us every year with a 50% average turnover rate that they think we're pretty crappy, right? That they're that willing to go chase the next deal, or right? And then we have teammate turnover that's always been an issue, right? And we have a heavy churn, some who leave the industry, some who don't. And like those things to me felt really like, as I explored this more, especially the past few months, now that I can just focus on this full time and trying to think through like, all right, what do we want to build first? What do we go to market with first? And I really want to just distill down like first principles. What are these real issues? Because we all see the symptoms. And you mentioned the tendency for like engineers will build very cool things that solve a very, very narrow problem. And part of that's born out of that same kind of symptom analysis, as opposed to kind of trying to get down to the root issues. And I think it's we don't entrust people to like to be able to rise up and learn these higher level concepts. I think a contributor to that is how much software training we have to do. I think most companies spend probably what half their training time on like how to navigate software. As a, you know, one thing I never got in a CPM class was Yardi.
That's
Right? It was just property management. And CAPS and CAM are the, right? But you're not being taught how to navigate your procurement platform. And yeah, those things are important, but also with today's technology, there's probably easier ways to do that. And maybe that unlocks some time to give back. And to allow people to essentially level up. Like I would think if I was an owner, I'd want my on-site PM to understand cap rates, right? Even at a very surface level, right? To understand the impact of the decisions they're making. We use this word budgets, but I don't think most people in the industry know what they mean. Because usually like spending stops. It's the intent that like spending stops when you go over budget. Like I don't know where that actually happens to like today, unless you've got like an owner who's really like micromanaging things. But as management professionals, like no, we just keep spending, like whatever, like we'll figure it out. We'll go 60, 90 days to like behind with our vendors. Doesn't matter to them. It's not like they're small businesses who are barely making payroll and could really use that money. And so it's just so that's and all of this I've like banged off like 40 things on this little rant, but that's why I say it's super, it's like completely broken, and there's not enough attention being paid to what the core root issues and challenges are. Because then if we're not fixing those, we're not actually fixing the problem. We're just building stuff on top that actually introduces more complexity, I think, than it solves. Right? Like I think I said this in a video I put out like a month ago, and in our effort to make the job easy, we also made it like infinitely more complex.
I think that is so right. And I think that rant that you just went on is a testament to precisely why there needs to be a real transformation of the business. And certainly don't let me put words in your mouth, but it seems like to me
I
that
just lose
you
my
agree
internet.
that it's all good. It seems like to me that the technology, look, some of that stuff is in the early innings, but that technology technology in general has caught up with systems and disciplines and processes and routines that we've been, that have been around for a very long bit of time, that are very useful, that are very necessary for our industry. And it seems like you are on a mission to marry those two things up so that you can disappear some of this kind of rote and routine work that people are doing, and sometimes in the wrong way.
Yeah, absolutely. I think tech can do a lot more than today because of the stuff that's happening with AI and some of these other and just where compute is right now. Mm-hmm. You know, just there's the ability to do a lot of things you couldn't do before, where you could plug some of these gaps. But you can also integrate like the education component into some of those processes, right? Like, you know, if someone's doing a month in close, why doesn't there, like, why aren't they being taught about what they're doing as they're doing it? And not in like a super overt way, but just in a subtle way, right? Because they're going to be doing it every month, so that they don't have to get it all immediately. It's just small reminders. But we do all these things at properties, but we don't actually like pull out the benefits of them, because people are just checking boxes.
Right.
And that's because they don't actually understand what they're doing. And it's because they haven't been taught. And all, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, it's because the people teaching them don't know. Right. Like we were in this run from what, 2011 ish to just last year.
Right.
Where it was easy, like as easy as this business gets. Right. And we allowed, I'm very fascinated by this idea of something it's called technological de-skilling. So it's basically like, it's a technological de-skilling is you have CRMs are the example I use most often, but I think and property management, revenue management's a great one to point to. So we always people who really understand markets and understood pricing, and we built revenue management tools for them to leverage that they then leveraged and they got lots of great results from. But then over time, because of that tool, the new people coming in don't have to necessarily have that underlying knowledge. And then you start to get time and continues to go on and go on. And then now today, you know, you ask someone, I have a friend, she lives at she just moved out of the nice, like one of the nicest properties in Austin, downtown high rise. Her rent was $4,300. The unit above her came on the market for $4,000. She got a renewal at 46. She said, why are you raising my rent? That her unit's on the market for $3,000 right now. And all those decisions were made because people didn't know, like they weren't taught the thing. So I think software can help, and that's because revenue management has made it to where no one thinks about pricing. It's like, why is the pricing? Well, the software told me. We at least got away from the matrices and the sales tour. That drove me nuts when those first, I'm sure you remember those, right? Like here, look at these. You haven't seen anything yet. And our sales process is going to be, look at these 825 prices on this grid and pick one. It's like, we haven't even shown this person like away from the desk. Like, what are we doing? So thankfully that went away for the most part, but the like just complete giving up of needing to know, because it's not just about the price. It's about like how you sell and how you have confidence in what you're selling because you understand where you fit in the hierarchy of the submarket. You know, it's more than just rent, but revenue management, I think, has contributed to a massive technological de-skilling. And pricing, like pricing theory of like,
right.
That, and you know, everyone's trapped in these stupid roll-ups. Like, I don't care what the average one bedroom rent is. Like I have a 550 square foot one bedroom and 1,000 square foot one bedroom. Those are not the same prospect. Yeah, like I don't need to know what the average one bedroom is. I need to, like floor plan comps are really, that's what I always looked at. Right. Like I floor plans, what's on 50 to 75 square feet on either side of it. What are their rents? What are their availability? That's what I'm going to try and abstract some insights from. Not the average rent at the entire property. Like,
right.
What is that actually telling me? Nothing. It's a vanity metric.
That's right. I think you unearthed something that I've been thinking about lately, and I'd love to hear your take on this. It's like, and revenue management is perfect. I'm going to use that one as an example because you brought it up. And I'm going to, your punchline, look, people have forgotten how to think because of this tool. And it really comes back to critical thinking, right? And it seems like to me, if people are not coming out of school or wherever they are before they come to us, if that's been extinguishing them. How do we resurrect critical thinking? Because the person, the example that you used, the person who is critically thinking about that, whether they're using a rev tool or not, would go, that doesn't make sense, but we don't do that. And I know it's a function of the technology, but how do you get critical thinking taught in today's world where lots of things are just automated for you?